Good afternoon. How are you all today? When I was first asked to present at this particular symposium, my thought was, well, the focus really where I spend most of my time is dealing with very, very cutting-edge neurotechnologies inclusive of very, very cutting-edge neuropharmaceutics, particularly the interface of convergent neuroscience and neurotechnology in a field that has become colloquially referred to as neuro-S&T, neuroscience and technology. Many of these corporations are, in fact, fairly large corporations, and without mentioning any particular names, you know a lot of these firms because these are the ones who deal with biotech, large pharma. But increasingly what you're also seeing is leveraging from smaller firms in the smaller level of industry through what is sometimes referred to as the triple helix phenomenon of the alignment of academia, government, and corporate sector. One of the areas that has been most affected by this is those that have particular niche disorders. Notably, over the past few years, we've seen areas of neurology, physical medicine, rehabilitation, increasingly psychiatry, and ever more pain management. I'll use the area of pain management as an exemplar, primarily because this was one of the incentivizations that arose out of the past 10 years' congressionally declared decade of pain control and research. Part of the agenda of that particular federal momentum was to bring together the research, development, test, and evaluation enterprise with those aspects of the field that would fortify a high translational impact and be most aligned with the needs of the polis. However, what we found in retrospective, and yet still an early retrospective, is that far too often the language of policy is not well aligned with the needs of those that is being served, and we tend to find as discrete pushing and pulling forces that very often create tensions, if not conflicts. First and foremost, I'd like to just disclose that I have no ongoing relationships. So as we move into the presentation, what I'd like you to understand is that if we use contemporary pain treatment as an exemplar, what we really find is that this is representative of a contemporary trend towards an increased biotechnologization of the medical field. Now, increasingly what we see is that policies and guidelines are attempting to orient the use of these techniques and technologies in such a way as to allow a broad diversity of both cutting-edge and low-tech approaches as needed by those patient populations that will maximize benefit. However, there is, in fact, a disconnect, and certainly Professor Marmer will discuss, at least in part, some of the putative mechanisms that may subserve that. But one of the things we find is that there's a strong momental push that has brought us to this particular point, as I have on the slide, that has been characterized at least over the past 20 to 25 years, the strong biomedical turn of the 1970s and 1980s, the Human Genome Project, and all of its hopes and aspirations, in some cases utopian, with regard to how genomics could then translate into personalized genetics, which is then carried through the pendulum swing of contemporary personalized medicine, what that could potentially mean. Certainly the decade of the brain that instantiated a think tank atmosphere both here in the United States and worldwide to generate the concepts and constructs of neuroscience as a viable translational entity for direct clinical care, and also offered a particular set of heuristics that have a large translational focus, not only in the way we develop the science and technology, but also the way we may apply these in a variety of different clinical scenarios. And last but not least, certainly the idea of focusing on one particular aspect of the human predicament, pain, as being somewhat ineffable, and as a result, the target of trying to bridge the notion of objectivity and subjectivity through these technologies. Well, obviously what we find is that much of this grew out of what sometimes referred to as neuroscientific convergence. That neuroscientific convergence was certainly multidisciplinary. We see the classical scientific disciplines. We also see genetics. We also see the humanities coming to the fore. And increasingly over the past 10 to 15 years, a very, very strong social scientific agenda that sought to bring those neuroscientific and neurotechnological approaches not only to the fore of clinical care, but also do so in a way that best met the humanitarian dimensions of medicine, and did so in such a way that was then leveraged back onto the potential of what guidelines and policies could do. I'll cut to the chase. In many ways, however, it failed. And it failed because of some of the things you're about to hear from my colleague. Much of that was a linguistic failure that failed to really align the ideals of what research was trying to do, its outcomes and products, with what the definitive needs were of those patients who would be served, and how guidelines and policies could, in fact, allow such resonance. But one of the things we saw that was very important and continues to be important is the role of research in creating these two last dynamics, the idea of going from tools to theory heuristics, and then ultimately with an expanding epistemological capital, utilizing this theoretical base to develop new tools. The trick, then, is how do we advance those tools into the translational foci? This has plagued this field that I spend much of my time with, called neuroscience and neurotechnology, colloquially referred to as neuro-S&T. You're probably very familiar with pretty pictures such as these, and they have great appeal. They also tend to leverage a lot of Wittgenstein's word games. We like to say, this does this, this does that, and that we should focus on doing these things and making it appropriate for the right type of care, for the right people in the right ways. Well, undeniably so. But I think one of the things we really need to focus on is exactly what it is these things can and cannot do, for whom, when, in what ways, and then align guidelines and policies in such a way that are factually oriented, both with regard to what the science and technology can do, and what should be done to articulate that to those needs of the individuals who suffer from not only pain as a viable disorder, but a number of other disorders. Clearly, these technologies hold great promise. But equally clearly should be the fact that these are indeed cutting edge. And as such, they're not available as universally as they can be or should be. Moreover, one of the things we recognize is that these technologies do not work solipsistically. They do not work alone. They work in concert. Very often what we find is the use of these assessment and diagnostic technologies is poised so as to be able to then leverage different types of information to allow much better evaluation, ultimately diagnosis, to then prompt that change in the critical step in the clinical encounter that says what is wrong with this patient, what can be done, and what should be done. But still, that critical step, articulating what should be done for the right reasons at the right time, from what can be done, requires both guidelines and policies to make these techniques and technologies available. And this is where we really confront the tensions that my co-speaker will address specifically with regard to the ongoing potential conflicts that may arise between the corporate sector, the clinical sector, the governmental sector, and the interface of those reciprocities in the real world. These are the tensions, and they are rather Janusian. What we find is that, without doubt, the principal pushers could be leveraged to be science's the knowledge of human endeavor. But let's define science for a moment. I define science in the classical sense, qua scientia. It's not just science for its own sake, the acquisition of knowledge, simply to have knowledge, but it is science as a human endeavor for human endeavor, which then, when contextualized to the area of biomedical science, has as its underlying maxim a translational focus. It must be articulated to those products and ends that serve those at whom it is directed. There we see the technological imperative. In fact, if you build it, use it. But if you build it and use it, the temperance of length's technological imperative is grounded both to strivings and flourish and in medicine to maxims of beneficence. And I would argue very strongly that these really are the underlying pushers that guides much of the academic enterprise of biomedical research and also much of the corporate enterprise. Now, I see eyebrows going up. Oh, the corporate monster. Now, just let's wait a minute. In fact, these particular maxims ring true. However, you have to understand that biomedicine does not exist in a socioeconomic stasis or in a vacuum. And as a consequence, these pushing forces are indeed pulled by a number of those influences that occur in the real world, quote, out there. And they are primarily economic and market values and incentives, as well as socio-political agenda. And these then create what is sometimes referred to in my line of work as lean. They will actually lean on the pushing forces so as to not only pull them in particular directions, but also perhaps influence what is studied, how it is studied, and how they are translated. If we then reduce this down to a final common denominator, it has been posed by our group and a number of others, not only in America but on the world stage, that what we may be seeing are two distinct forms of ethos and dissonance. On one hand, we may see the ethos of science, again, qua scientia, not just for its own good, but as a human endeavor, for human endeavor. Medicine, as formally defined here as the art, skill, and techniques of treating those made vulnerable by their condition of illness, the patient, patio, the one who suffers, and business, which, even by the most formal definition, business, although may have an ethos of profit, is still leveraged within the human sphere and should focus upon humans. The question then is, how can we align the corporate enterprise of biomedical business with the ends, the telos, the goals of science and medicine to serve human flourishing and, in fact, identify those viable areas where neuro-S&T, among other forms of science and technology, may have some viable good. And what we see here is some forms of restrictive translation, impediments along the way caused by these leaning and pushing forces and pulling forces in concert that very often do not work synergistically but pull themselves apart. The question then we must ask is, how do we balance commutative justice, that is, the unequal distribution of those goods and resources based upon unequal need, with frank distributive justice, which in fact imparts that the notion of simple rational actors and unlimited resources is unrealistic? How then do we distribute these goods of both high and low tech to those who need them? Essentially, who gets the goodies? Well, if in fact one of the things we're looking to do then is generate some underlying informing of policy, the two principal domains where we most like to work are the two that I have illustrated for you here. One is the research translational effort, the idea of going from books to bench to bedside, going from theoretical knowledge to the tools heuristics that is necessary to then translate that big into care. This is what we like to call medicine-based evidence, a play on words you may be familiar with. The idea here is saying, what are we studying, why are we studying, and how can we advance it to the ends of a right and good healing for those who, in fact, require these goods and services? How do we then co-opt the corporate, academic, and governmental sector so as to be able to work, in fact, collaboratively in terms of the language that is tendered and what that language renders in real-world scenarios of commutative and distributive provision of these goods and resources? But ultimately, to do that, we recognize that the market influences that are very strong, pulling and leaning forces, must also gain some purchase and must also at least be encountered or accounted for. And as a consequence, the lower equation is really where the rubber hits the road, dealing with the notion of going from boardroom to the allocation of bucks to then create a more viable translation of bench to bedside. And in fact, what we see here is the need to then fund research outcomes with more provisionally based ends. Moreover, the idea that the corporate infrastructure can indeed be leveraged in such a way through effective guidelines so as to make those areas of science and technology that are most necessary available to those who need them. Now, nothing is more boring than a bunch of economics. And particularly at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm not going to crunch a bunch of numbers for you, not least of which because I'm not an economist. However, one of the things that becomes important to understand is if we're going to move towards some level of alignment, there must be some resonance in the economic sphere. My colleague, Dr. Oli Benedicta at Stanford, and I have tried to analyze what, in fact, might be done so as to be able to get the shoulds viable and up and running. This certainly calls for at least some level of microeconomic sensitivity within a macroeconomic infrastructure, and we've looked to some of the work of Amartya Sen and Ani Satz, your colleague up at Yale, who has, in fact, done a rather nice job in defining how supply and demand side for science and technology might be equilibrated in best balance. A rather complicated calculus, but one that we feel is rather doable through a number of different approaches to microeconomics, including the idea of Shatovsky criteria and balancing Pareto and non-Pareto dynamics. Clearly, one of the issues here is that the large idea, the large macroeconomic idea of having a very, very large end and serving only that large end to then compromise for costs going into various studies might not necessarily be the way to go. Because as we learn more about particular disease entities, what we tend to find is a far more communitarian orientation, one that focuses perhaps upon stakeholders and shareholders who have particular things in common, a disease type, a need, etc., and as a result generate funding in that way so as to definitely use the idea of theory to tools when now the tools are not just scientific but also economic. How then can we work to enable certain policies that are on the books to best leverage such an approach so as to maximize and optimize the viability of what may be personalized care that is microeconomically sensitive to the allocation and distribution of science and technology at both high and low tech, together with the strong pulling forces that may be confounds? Well, our group is looking increasingly towards language of the National Pain Care Act, which may in fact have to be revised and is up for such a revision in year 2012. Certainly the Health Care Act, and there are particular aspects of the 2012 to 2014 agenda that speak very strongly to the utilization and provision of both high and low-tech science and technology based upon individual, communitarian, and commutative justice needs. And last but not least, one of the things that we've been working with since 2008, something which is known as the National Neurotechnology Initiative, which is now in its second version for leveraging in 2012 to 2013, and may in fact be a strong agenda item in the forthcoming election, irrespective of whatever partisan orientation. The idea here is simple. We feel that there's some type of a limited communitarian ethic that would need to be bespoken and articulated. Our goal here is to try to create a cooperative effort of both share and stakeholder groups so as to engage the conjoinment of venture capital funding, which may actually, at least in part, revise the face of what the translational research effort really looks like. It doesn't do away with the large corporate entities, but it also helps to ground the actual purposes of what those corporate entities may do. It may allow some subsidiary off-sharing that then breaks forth particular aspects of the large corporate enterprise to focus on key problems of how science and technology may be leveraged to treat particular groups with particular disorders within a particular time course. Moreover, one of the things we also recognize is that there may be a need to revise some of the paradigms and protocols of the actual research itself, the research, development, test, and evaluation of certain forms of science and technology so as to be more communitarian and more cooperative. Now, this in no way impugns the stringency or rigor of such approaches, but rather utilizes the epistemological capital we have at hand, inclusive that which is gained from the Human Genome Project, the decade of the brain, the decade of pain control and research, and increasingly, I would argue, as that capital begins to grow because of the convergence of these scientific approaches to recognize the specific needs of patient populations that may then be able to segregate key characteristics in what has been called attribute-treatment interaction. What this actually does is this streamlines cost in such a way as to be leverageable for both big commercial enterprises and smaller commercial enterprises, and we believe is also purchasable and leverageable through well-defined and articulated healthcare policy. There are certain components of the Healthcare Policy Act in the 2014 to 2015 agenda that may, in fact, speak to this very closely. Certainly, one of the things that's going to be needed is a shift in the way some of this work is done, and perhaps a realignment and reorientation of what large and small corporate infrastructures are actually doing vis-a-vis those demonstrated needs of the patients who require these services and the basic research infrastructure that determines what the nature of various pathologies are, et cetera. Obviously, what we're looking to do here is to crack an egg. We're looking to move forward. I could stand here all afternoon and I could paint a dismal picture to you and say, we haven't done this yet. I could talk about the posture of large corporate enterprise, small venture capital, and how much of science and technology remains somewhat unavailable or impeded against high translational foci by a number of forces, not least of which is that some of the governmental posturing with regard to how these particular policies need to be articulated and designed and enacted have stalled or have been inappropriate, have not been thorough enough. Are there agenda that also loom large with regard to the commercial sector, in some cases, bastardizing the probity of what can and should be done? Yes, of course. Do we need police groups that are viable to make sure that, in fact, that probity is maintained throughout and that also there are diversified commercial infrastructures that can maximize the translational throughput of science and technology to best meet the needs of those patients? Absolutely. How are we going to do that? Look at the egg. Think about the egg for a moment. What do you got on the outside? You got a hard shell. The living stuff, the stuff that develops, the stuff that is fertilizable, that will ultimately hatch forth with all the right conditions and be the phoenix that flies away, well, that's on the inside. So what I offer you is what we have tried to advance with an ongoing agenda at our institute to actually develop the infra and extra structures of science, technology, ethics, and policy. We use the egg analogy. Look to the inside of the egg, if you will. It must begin with our current epistemological capital that then sets forth the acknowledged facts and realities of what can be done. Perhaps this then gives us what should be done. What is the nature of these pathologies? What is the nature of physiology? How, in fact, can we then generate personalized physiological medicine? And then how do we target those tools that are at our disposal to match the theory-to-tools heuristic? This then gives us the focus and telos of science and biomedicine. It is, in fact, a human endeavor for human endeavor. This then takes us to integral premises of medicine as a profession that ultimately then translate down into the nature of the clinical encounter with each and every patient treated. It refosters the idea of going from epistemological capital down to the ethic and articulation of patient care, both individually and for groups, recognizing the uniquity of individuals and groups, also recognizing that, in fact, many of them are cohort. How can these be appropriated so as to maximize the throughput of science and technology? There's a mutual informing that occurs, but note also that just like the egg, if I do not have a shell that provides protection as this grows, that provides rigidity and solidity, this too will flounder. This too becomes nothing more than proverbial snot on a plate. What I need is the shell. The shell provides me guidelines and policies that are both informative and informed by this epistemological capital and ultimately feed back to support it so that its common point of tension and articulation is where most of the rubber hits the road, that bottommost point, serving individuals and the public, because I argue that that, in fact, is the role of both policy and the body politic. And thus, what we find is that this interaction, this reciprocity of a growing fund of epistemological capital and capability within science, and the role of science to parse what works, what doesn't, in whom, and do so with a high translational focus, and again, we're working within biomedical science, must in fact be supported by guidelines and policies that, number one, fund the appropriate research towards the appropriate ends, and number two, make the outputs and products of such research viable and available as a translational focus. Clearly, the problem we have is that without this, what will tend to happen is guidelines and policies alone without such information are a brittle and fragile shell that will in fact fracture under the weight of pressure that is put upon us in the real-world scenarios of patient care. Our goal is to try to articulate this, working in concert with a number of groups, academically, governmentally, and also within the commercial sector. A challenge? Without a doubt. A vista forward? Absolutely. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Professor Giordano. That is most illuminating. Maybe we can have one or two quick questions or comments. If there's anybody, yes.
Is there actually, in effect, a National Pain Act?
Yes, there is. The National Pain Act, as you know, there were actually three proposed. The first was proposed in the late 1980s, failed dismally. The second was re-proposed by Roland Gallagher and colleagues, and that was launched in the middle part of the 1990s. It gained some traction, and then during the early part of the 2000s, 2003 and 2004, was actually formalized as a congressional act, which was then fortified and ratified. The question then becomes as to whether or not that has actually been effective in all of its components. There are four components of the act, as you know. The first was the research, development, test, and evaluation, which we hear just again in Mr. Obama's pleas yesterday for the advancement of the FDA to be able to push new drugs through, but do so in a way that is stringent and rigorous. The second is the idea of engaging both high and low biotech in such a way that is going to be available not only to patients, but also available to clinicians. The third was the alignment of healthcare policy and law, so that in fact the war on pain is not also the war on drugs, which then creates collateral damage, and of course there's a huge problem with that. And the last certainly was the provision of these resources in a translational focus through the use of healthcare, insurance, subsidy, etc., that would make these available to patients in much more of a demand side versus simply a supply side, and that's been problematic. Yes, ma'am.
Next is Professor Marmor. With the title of Healthcare Reform and Corporate Influence, column, Real and Imagined Influence. Professor Marmor.
Well, I'm glad Jim went first because he had the optimistic part. I'm going to have the pessimistic, I was going to say the realistic part. But what he was speaking about was the connection between corporate life, small and big firms, and the frontiers of science, and that's not what I'm going to be talking about at all. What I want to do is challenge what has been often claimed to be the explanation for why we have so much trouble in American medical care and reform, namely corporate influence. That is a conventional explanation that but for the influence of the insurance firms, of the pharmaceutical firms, the hospital supply firms, we would have a radically improved medical care system of delivering funding and distributing medical care. I don't think that's true, even though I wouldn't for a moment hesitate at the description of corporate influences being attempted all the time on the cost side, on the supply side, on every, in the regulation. Of course they do that. But the central point after 40 years in this field, the central point I want to communicate to a group in the public health world is, in order to make sense of large developments in the economic and political sphere, you have to take into account three major sources of influence. Three, not one, three. One is you have to ask yourself, what are the prevailing and dominant ideas about what's worth doing at any point in time? I'm going to connect this to health reform, what we've been through since 2007, in the run-up to the election, all the way through to where we are now. So you have to be clear about the distribution of ideas about what to do or what should be done, and ideas as well about how things can be done. The second component is you have to have a clear notion of the structure of the organizations and institutions into which those ideas are put or expressed. And the third is you have to have a sense of, a descriptively accurate sense, of the distribution of material interests, corporate interests, interests of professionals, interests of academics, God knows. And the combination, what Rudolf Klein and I have called the three I's, ideas, institutions, and interests, are the component parts of any sensible discussion of what governments do and don't do, in our view. That's the claim. Everybody clear about what the claim is? Okay. I just want to say in passing, we have a lot to be unhappy about in American medical care, including with the reform of 2010. Our costs are not in any sense under control. The quality of American medicine is highly uneven. The complexity of getting anything in it is a growing and serious problem. The question of accountability, who's accountable for it, is utterly dismayingly complex. So there's lots to worry about, and people were enormously hopeful in the 2008 election that finally we were going to get an alignment, not an alignment between corporate and other interests, but an alignment of the political institutions so that the Congress and the President would be held by the same party. There would be grounds for cooperation among them, and the gap between the problems defined and the adequacy of the remedies would be squeezed some. I mean, as I was listening to Jim, I kept on thinking, America is fabulous at creating aspirational goals. You could get to the moon, God knows, but we have a much harder time dealing with the ghetto. Getting to an alignment between scientific, corporate, and scientific purposes, it's going to be hard. But that's nothing compared to the difficulty of narrowing the gap between what Americans say they would like in medical care and what they get. So, with that, let me turn to the assertions I want to make about corporate influence. Let me take five areas and assert for all five that the explanation for what took place is best located in the ideas and institutions and not in the power of interest to transform our agenda or our outcomes. Take, for example, the one that I know best and I'm best known for, which is the politics of Medicare. Why do we have Medicare in the United States? Is it because, and why did it take the shape it did of having a separate physician Part B, compared to Part A? It was certainly the case that the American Medical Association was against it. It is certainly the case that the National Association of Manufacturers opposed it. But it's not the case that either of those things explains why we have the complicated form of Medicare we do. It's because it was opposed from the very beginning by a coalition of conservative Democrats and Orthodox Republicans whose ideology and ideas were parallel to those corporate interests, not caused by those corporate interests. And the only thing that made a big difference was the overwhelming victory in 1964 of the Democrats, which knocked out that conservative coalition. In short, both here in Canada, in Britain, in France, in Japan, the corporate interests are forever looking after their interests, sometimes benign, sometimes not. That's not the explanation for our special problem. The special explanation for our problem is that in order to deal with a big problem, to which you have to have a big change, you have to go through a set of political institutions that are architecturally designed to make that hard to do. We empower negative majorities. We don't even need a majority, negative minorities. The key element in 2009 and 10 was whether or not you had 60 votes in the U.S. Senate. If you didn't have 60 votes in the U.S. Senate, you could have filibusters that could stop anything. And as long as you had a president and a set of allies who believed that the purpose of that first administrative 2 years was to get it done, where it was meant health reform, it didn't make much of a difference how bad the it was. So we are now left with a smorgasbord of health care reform that emerged from trying to enact a Republican conception of reform in a Congress nominally Democratic and held to ransom by a set of political institutions and rules that allowed minority to control what was possible. Now, you've heard it from me here, right? That's not what you hear most of the time. Now, let me give you 3 or 4 other illustrations of how important this is. Let me just take one that, if any of these illustrations you've already known about or heard, put up your hand, because I'd be glad to look at you directly and see whether my take on it is similar to yours. By accident, I happened to be involved and asked to be an expert witness in something called average wholesale price fraud. Do you know what that is? Any of you? One person does in the room, and whom I know, knows about this. Well, this is a multi-billion dollar world in which Medicare and Medicaid have been fleeced for years by the some in the pharmaceutical industry, who have, to use a technical term, lied about what their prices were and tried to compete with other firms by marketing the spread between what they told falsely to the government was their price and the price they're actually offering to druggists and to physicians. Many billions of dollars have already been recovered from this, but you know where it's recovered? It's recovered in federal district courts and state courts. And none of you and none of the people I deal with spend any time reading about those things. It's fascinating. Now, there's the case where an institution actually helps. We have both a doctrine of fraud with respect to government. If you tell something to the government in the course of billing them that's fraudulent, you can either go to jail or you certainly are going to be fined. And we have a set of institutions, interestingly enough, I didn't know much about this, called the whistleblower statutes, which give people financial incentives to find fraud. And so that's one area, and we have a judge in Boston, Judge Saris, who is forcing one after another the pharmaceutical firms to give up on their excuse. And let me just tell you a word about that excuse. Think about this like vaccination against bad ideas. If you think about it that way, you'll see my point. What the pharmaceutical industry, or some firms in it more accurately, claimed, that it was of course true that they were marketing the spread. If they could give a cheaper price to one doctor than another, they could get an advantage over one of their competitors. And they said that's the competitive market at work. And they said, what's more, the government over the period, let's say 1976 to 2007, didn't change the rules dramatically. They changed them sometimes, and occasionally they tried to increase the return, the rebate that would come from the pharmaceutical, but they couldn't get through Congress the right kind of capacity to negotiate directly with the pharmaceutical industry. So the pharmaceutical industry claimed that the inaction of the government meant that the government had acquiesced in this conduct, and therefore they were not responsible. And it took many thousands of words to explain to these judges that inaction is not logically compatible with acquiescence, that in order to acquiesce in something, you have to know what you're doing. And they didn't know what they were doing because they kept it private. So that's an arena that I've come into contact with that's important in this respect. But in addition, if you, let's take Part D for a moment of Medicare. Somebody moan about Part D? Did I hear that correctly? And you moan because you find it incomprehensible?
No, because it costs so much of the donut
hole. Okay. Well, so you find it comprehensible but disappointing.
Correct.
All right. Well, let's ask, why did we produce in 2003 an utterly disappointing form of a drug benefit, which has a donut hole, huge complexity, built on a model of senior citizens and disabled people choosing among incomprehensible options? Why did we do so? Did we? Is that the case that the pharmaceutical industry was keen to have this happen? Actually, earlier they were not. They initially resisted the idea, scared to death that they were going to get a powerful American government negotiating directly with them. They were not the source of the impulse for Part D. They were just an important element, one element, in a clash, the characteristics of which you should know about. What happened was everybody was worried about the election of 2004. And everybody was worried they would be characterized, that is, on the Republican and the Democratic side, they would be characterized as the enemy of the elderly's need for drug insurance, even though a fair number of people have drug insurance with supplementary coverage. So they competed one with the other, and Teddy Kennedy said, over my dead body in the Senate, will anything go forward which does not have universal eligibility for Medicare? That's the central premise of Part A. In the Office of Management and Budget, on the Republican side in the administration, said over their dead body, this will not cost more than $40 billion a year or $400 billion over 10 years. So there were two estimates. For the Kennedy plan, it was $800 billion. For the Bush plan, it was $400 billion. Universal or for low-income elderly. So what they did was combine the budget for the Bush administration with the eligibility for the Kennedy plan. And then actuaries went crazy and produced donut holes, which is the only way you can do it if you've got a bill that can't possibly cover the... So, I could go... You get the picture? What I'm really doing is not challenging at all the view that corporate America is made up of a great mix of organizations, all of which are held in check, whether they're for-profit or non-profit, by the need to make their resources equal to their expenses and some more. And I want to say that fact is something that should be accepted like the weather. That's always going to be the case. And you may be able to make bargains with part of it, as Jim was saying to you. But that the reason the outcomes of reform in America have such a gap between what we hoped for and what we get is that we've made decisions along the way to accept an intermediate step outcome as satisfactory, as a step towards what we want, and we've been continually disappointed in that. And that's what I'm, for whatever time I've got. I've got 5 more minutes, something like that, right? I want to turn from that general claim to try to illustrate that with the health reform of 2010. I want to begin by saying that I accept, and I think I could document and persuade many of you, that in 2008, the election of 2008, coming into the Congress of 2009, although it was Democratic nominally, there was nothing like a policy majority for any form of national health insurance that anybody would recognize if they had looked back at, so let's say, the Kennedy bills of the 1970s or thought about Medicare for All. It was not doable. It was not doable both because of the cloture rules in the Senate and because you had Blue Dog Democrats in the House who were going to fight like hell to stop you from doing so. So I accept the constraint that President Obama and his allies could not have done a straightforward expansion of Medicare to everybody or a straightforward version of any national health insurance scheme you could have imagined, which would have had a chance, on the basis of comparative experience, of actually producing an expansion of insurance at the same time the rate of increase in expenditures might have been lowered. But that does not mean that they could not do that, does not mean what they did makes sense. Because what they did, in fact, was two things that I want to emphasize. One, the president never, this is the role of ideas here, the president never explained why universal coverage was such a morally compelling idea. He talked about his mother and grandmother, but he didn't give anybody any, nothing in the world of social justice was invoked. No idea. Was this, do we believe in equal access to care for equal illness? Is money not to play a role in what care you get? Is this different from the rest of American market life? Is medical care, like primary school, a special kind of service that although we recognize there's economics of it, we're not going to allocate it by ability and willingness to pay? Did he ever say, utter the expression, ability and willingness to pay? Or ability to benefit as an alternative formulation? Not, I don't think you can find one speech that's organized that way. Instead, what happened? We took the Massachusetts plan reform of 2006 and universalized it and added an enormous number of bells and whistles that have no coherent relationship to any of that. So we have health reforms and an overall health reform that is hostage to the very institutions that I was talking about. If it's true that a minority can control a lot of the agenda of our Congress, particularly the Senate, then it is doubly dangerous to commit yourself to benefits in 2014 to 2020 because you have no view whatsoever of the likelihood that you'll ever get there. Medicare was meant to be the first big step towards national health insurance under social insurance arrangements. It was deflected by big forces. Both Vietnam and urban riots helped to explain why not. But it was coherent. The next group would have been children. After that, indeed, was disabled. There was a sort of trajectory of it with the same mindset. What's the trajectory here? The expansion of Medicaid at the very time that states are in deep trouble because of the recession? What conception links the Medicaid expansion to the rest of Americans? Are we going to have four levels of care in America? Bronze, platinum, the very use of jewelry and mining term seems an odd one. Anyway, I think I've made my point. That's all I wanted to do today was talk to you bluntly about why when you see the effort to influence public policy by corporate interests, you should accept that as absolutely common everywhere one can be. It's not eradicable, and it doesn't really concentrate on for-profit firms. I went to St. Louis to participate in a trial in which 37 hospitals, this will be my last point, 37 hospitals were suing tobacco companies. I know you can imagine in public health association on the whole it's not favorable to tobacco. Have I got that right? But in this case, the tobacco firms were telling the truth and the hospitals were telling lies. Unbelievable lies. Because there was money on the other side of the table. They wanted to get $1 billion. And here is their argument. It's staggering, even as I imagine telling it to you. These 37 hospitals said that for smoking-related illness of patients who became bad debt patients or ex-ante were charity patients, cost them $1.5 billion, which they wanted back to distribute among them. How did they measure the $1.5 billion worth of damages? How had they lost that $1.5 billion? Well, they took, and for those of you who understand hospitals, you understand how absurd this is, they took what's called the charge master list of thousands of hospital bills, measured that against payments made on behalf of those who were poor or became poor, and treated that gap as the loss they incurred. Not their marginal costs, but the gap between their price and the payments on their behalf. And those prices, on average, were 5 times greater than what those hospitals accepted for the same procedures from Aetna or other insurance firms. Right? So the devils The devils, the drug industry, not drug, the tobacco industry, was going to be taxed to pay for the hospitals through lies. Well, your grandmother told you that's not a good idea. And thank God we have a judicial system which actually at the factual level can distinguish with help between falsehood and accuracy. Thank you very much. I thought I recognized you. My glasses are not quite so powerful.
Can you explain why all those years ago when Medicare was passed, things were so much simpler, and now over the past 40 years, or it's become so much more complicated, the policy process and end products for healthcare?
Well, the policy process more complicated, or actually the policy elements as well? Both?
Okay.
Okay. Well, one thing, this might surprise you, one reason it's a lot more complex is that the Congress has become more internally democratic in some respects. Over time, it's particularly true in the 1970s and 80s. As you made the chairs of various committees less subject to the control of the heads of the House and the Senate, you lost some of the hierarchical control of what could happen. Wilbur Mills didn't want Medicare, but Wilbur Mills could control a good deal, as you remember, of how Medicare was treated. So powerful hierarchical leaders were able to present and restrain the complexification. But you see it very much. Any bill that has to go through three separate committees in 2010, it went through three separate committees in the House with enormous and unusual cooperation and then fell victim to the differences between the House and the Senate. So that's one reason. But there's another more profound point which actually touches on the role of ideas. Since the 1970s, the conception of what is a sensible set of arrangements for medical care access and financing and delivery has become more complicated than it was when I first entered this. When I first entered this field, and some of the people in the room will have come in the same time, Blue Cross and Blue Shield were the dominant nonprofit private actors in the insurance world, and all Medicare was really was the public version of Blue Cross with a more complicated version of Blue Shield and Major Medical. It didn't need a lot of explanation to say this is going to cover 60 days of hospital care plus some lifetime reserve. And 99.9% of Americans would never have to confront anything more than 60 days in any one episode. So that's a secondary. But the third, and I think most important, and it will take much longer to go into and I won't in any length, is that in the wake of the economic troubles of the 1970s, the vision of American government as a source of problems rather than a source of solutions gained a lot of sway. And so the world that's described best by the activities of the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, and the American Enterprise Foundation, that wave of ideological forces, basically, continued to communicate the conception that if only medical care was distributed and financed the way other consumer goods are, everything would be a lot better. The new version of it is skin in the game, even though cost sharing by patients is an idiotic way to try to control the cost of medical care, and it is rightly considered a tax on being ill or fearful. But that ideological development has now swept into the world so that if you, as I did with my wife this last weekend, went to UCLA Law School to a conference, a bunch of tax lawyers are talking about healthcare as if they're talking about the distribution of automobiles. So you've got a lingo of choice of insurance plan as if it's the same thing as a choice of a restaurant. So that It's in the interaction between those ideas ideologically, the complexification of the Congress, and the lack of a social movement to readdress that after Vietnam. I mean, Vietnam was a crucial part. It's a long story, but that's all I can do for now. Thanks. Now, if we're being talked about, why don't we go sit down there and let the... How's that?
Well, thank you very much. I mean, this was two very wonderful presentations. The next speaker is, the reactor, I suppose, would be the proper term, is Professor William Wist. Bill Wist is the scientist who wrote the first article that appeared in the American Journal of Public Health on Corporations. Before that, and Corporations and Health, before that, the subject of the structure of the corporation and the ideology of corporations and all the various features of those major institutions of American life had really never been touched in the public health literature, at least as represented by the American Journal of Public Health. Something like the idea of class, for instance, was missing until about 1980. It was very important, but didn't appear in American discussions of health care. Professor Wist, with his article, has certainly brought up a very important question, which is now being taken up by many other workers. He's going to respond, so this will be the first, the academic respondent, and the next one will be an advocacy respondent.
Thank you, Renee, for giving me this opportunity to be on a reaction panel to hear Dr. Giordano and Marmer's presentations. Gave us really a lot to think about, and certainly in ways that I haven't looked at it. I've never looked at the inside of an egg like that. So I was really glad to have that enlightening experience. I agree with a major premise of both of their discussions, and that is two aspects. One is that influence of ideology, I think, is absolutely an underlying foundation. And the other aspect is the importance of policy and regulation. My perspective is, and I'm not sure that it fits with what they're saying, but my perspective is that the ideology and the policy and regulation both are generated by the corporate world and from the way that in the United States our definition of what corporations are and what they can do has evolved, particularly since around the Civil War, where they have more and more rights of personhood. And with those rights that have come from corporations, they have gained greater and greater access to the policy and regulation influence, and as well through the influence on the ideology. And those policy and regulation influences come predominantly from three areas. One is their ability, particularly since 2010, January, the Supreme Court decision, the Citizens United decision, which allowed corporate influence in elections to be much greater from previously where corporate officials could contribute to election campaigns through PACs, which had limited amounts of money, and it was the person's, that corporate official, employee, stockholder's money. The Citizens United decision said that
Corporations can now spend from the corporate revenue unlimited amounts of money for uncoordinated or independent advertising for elections. And we saw already the effects of that in the 2010 midterm election, where huge amounts more money than ever been spent on a midterm election, and it did end up in changes in Congress. And you can look at who got the money and who got elected. And in 2012 election, they were expected to spend $8 billion, $2.5 to $3.5 million in television advertising, one of the sort of essentials of campaigning now. So any politician, regardless of which, as Republican or Democrat, has to have a lot of money to get elected. And in that last election, we also, not even an election, but we could see from those people who got donations from special corporate interests and which legislation then they supported. And in some cases, for example, with the TARP bailout and the financial bill that was passed, it was a 14-1 of those who took the Wall Street position versus those who opposed the Wall Street position. And there are another number of other examples like that. So the other aspect, and I'll come back a little bit to this again in terms of ideology, the other aspect is lobbying. And I can give you some specific examples on expenditures. I brought all these notes if people really want to know. It's just unbelievable, the amount of lobbying and election campaign contributions. But sort of related to the lobbying aspect is they have greater access than you and I would have by any means. I mean, you and I cannot go out, unless you're one of those in this room, cannot go out and play golf with our senator. We can't even get access if we go to their office to them normally. We get an aide. And we don't help, normally we don't help write the bills. And related to that, the revolving door, congressional committees are particularly important. And there's this giant flow back and forth, but staffers on those committees in Congress, huge numbers of them, I mean, in the thousands, are going into lobbying. And many, many lobbyists or industry people come into both those congressional committees and offices, and they also, and the agencies that are supposedly regulating them. So they're able to influence the regulation that way as well, not only through the election campaigns and who gets elected, whether they agree with them or not, and whether they're going to sort of pay them back, sort of a quid pro quo, or whether their ideology is the same. It doesn't matter. We've got this group that's hearing the corporate interest many times more than they are the public interest. So those are three aspects: election campaign, lobbying, and revolving door, that are the predominant influence on policy and regulation. And the other is, in terms of ideology, we have had, since the 1970s, a predominance of the neoliberal economic model. But the influence of, and the Washington Consensus model, but even before that, our country has this history that's evolved to that point, in part because of the influence that corporations have on society's public perception in a number of ways. So not only do we have all this advertising that influences consumerist society, we have the public relations arm, whether you're talking about the AstroTurf groups or you're just talking about news releases going to the press, television press releases, whatever, and their influence in education, whether it's elementary school nutrition programs sponsored by McDonald's, or whether you're talking about a corporation that's funding research in a university, which says you can't release your data until we approve it, if at all, and you have to do it under these guidelines, and they can totally control that research in the contracts that the institutions have with those. So this influence, and also then media, whether it's news or something else, is owned by corporations that can determine what messages come on. And it's become more and more consolidated with fewer people controlling it, And with budget cuts, because of, in large part, because of lower tax, corporate tax returns to the government, revenues to the government by the millions of dollars every year, if they pay any at all, and there's data showing many of them don't. So we have fewer people to monitor, to enforce regulations. So there's this whole numerous ways in which the corporations have influenced the ideology so that the average citizen just accepts any message and doesn't even critically analyze whether this message really is true or whether it's a PR, or they don't even know how or even know this exists. And it's become so subconscious that they don't do that, and many legislators don't either, or policymakers in general. I mean, this ideology has been so predominant and ingrained in us through these multiple ways that somebody can have this lens on an issue, whether it's for education or healthcare or whatever, and they're not even aware that they're just sort of reacting with the same viewpoint regardless of what the issue is, whether it's education or health or the environment. So, again, just sort of summarizing it up, there are a number of ways which corporations influence policies and regulations, which both speaker indicated was very important. And also, the corporations have a strong influence on the ideology, which both speakers indicated was very important in what happens in healthcare. So I'll just kind of stop at that point then.
Thank you very much. We'll go on directly to Charlie Gray. We had considered quite a number of advocacy organizations. We felt that Gray's organization of Gray's whole personality in the work of the Center for Corporate Policy was possibly one of the prominent ones. Charlie?
So, thank you very much. I want to run down some ideas that come largely in reaction as I heard the two presentations. Before I do that, I wanted to tout Bill's book, which I have a chapter in. This is a book he edited last year that I got into an extension of some of the arguments that are in the first chapter of our book, which we wrote after Enron when we stepped back from the immediate issues of accounting and banking and all the other, you know, it was a crisis that it was like the proverbial elephant. If you talked to someone who was in a certain profession, you got their view of what the crisis was about. It was very complicated. So we step back and look at the question of corporate power in that book. And I have copies here if anybody's interested afterwards. So I know very little about research, I will admit. I'm an activist and advocate, as was mentioned. But I will say from my observation of the presentation, which, again, I'm not that familiar with Dr. Giordano's world, but I will say that it is unquestionable from what little I do know about the healthcare sector that we are not in a situation where public interests and ideas, the three legs of the stool are sort of, you know, out of balance. And what I mean by that is that within the corporate world, for instance, even the research departments, you can see this in the pharmaceutical world, are basically run by marketing people. Like Pfizer, for instance, has this program called CRAM, Central Research Assists Marketing, which determines, and I think you would agree on that. And I would be very dubious of any public interest represented by shareholders. I think as people, yes, they do have human interests, but in their roles as shareholders, they're very ineffective, except for raising issues when they're outside shareholders, perhaps at times. But it's a very poor substitute for public interest, exercises to have shareholders. And then finally, there is a group that I would just recommend to you to look at, which is called Knowledge Economy International, KEI Online is their name, and they work on things like compulsory licensing of AIDS drugs, and they're pushing a public goods proposal within the WTO framework so that it's not all just a race to the bottom, that you have public interest dialogues within even the most conservative and pro-corporate rights institutions of the world. More comments I have would address Dr. Marmol's presentation, which I largely agree with. Let me just start with, he mentioned wholesale price fraud and the fact that there are these large cases that fall under the False Claims Act law. He called it an institution, and it has really become an institution. It's called trial lawyers. And trial lawyers have been largely demonized in this country, so we don't use and we don't praise trial lawyers for serving what I consider to be almost an immune cell function in the body politic. They go, if you have a law like that, they go after the corruption and the disease. And we've had 30 years of tort reform restricting the rights of defrauded and injured people represented by trial lawyers, that tort reform being led by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in conjunction with other interests, some of whom I'm sure are represented at this conference, has largely restricted the ability of people to use other laws that are similar. We also need criminal sanctions. One of the bills that we introduced is called the Dangerous Products Warning Act. We put it in there as a kind of a discussion bill, which would criminalize both if a company introduces a product knowing that it could cause bodily injury or death, if there's any evidence of that, you not only can sue the company itself criminally, but also top managers. I have details on that. The bill itself is H.R. 322, and you can talk to me afterwards if you want more information on that. Of course, it's not going anywhere for the very three I's that Dr. Marmol discussed, the ideas, institutions, and interests. And I would suggest that we all get much more familiar with the history of this over the past 40 years. You've seen it, you know it, you know various tentacles of it, but it spans the entire society in many ways. And what I've come to the conclusion is that basically we are a colonized society, colonized by corporations. If you look back at 1971, when then Justice Lewis Powell drafted a memo for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, he basically laid out an argument that corporations, particularly the chamber and the ideological foundations that got active in the wake of this, including the Business Roundtable, which was formed the next year, should focus on three or four areas of public institutions and dominate them. In other words, take over public institutions like the courts was one area he urged them to take on, and I'm going to get back to that later. On campus, he was he identified the student unrest in those days, activists, anti-war activists, consumer advocates like Ralph Nader and so forth. And the media, which of course we all know, the media has become more and more, and in fact even before Powell's time, Bozell and others had become more active in taking over and pushing the media. Accuracy in media was formed a few years before Powell wrote his memo. And now that's why we have so many more institutions on the right here in Washington and so many ideas that come out of the right. I mentioned Cato, the American Enterprise Institute, Heritage. There are dozens and dozens of these, some of them not here in Washington, but most effective ones are. And for that reason, recall under this healthcare deliberation, one of the things that happens in Washington is not just what gets debated. The most important thing is what doesn't get debated. And you're right that the president did a really bad job of not using the bully pulpit and mobilizing that coalition that he had created to get himself elected. I think that was the biggest failure. And the fact that he picked this issue to be his signature issue in the first year, and he didn't mobilize people for that, really tells you a lot about the lack of character that he had, the lack of courage that he had, and probably the kind of institutional opposition that he knew he faced. And he tried to get around that, I think, in terms of brokering compromise. But there were these preemptive concessions to the pharmaceutical industry and so forth that I think were really, really disempowered his own base and made people very skeptical. And that is a problem that he is, I think, at this point trying to correct for 2012. But it also is a problem that in Congress, you had the Finance Committee under Max Baucus unwilling to even allow the public option to be scored compared to the other options. So, you know, it's gotten to the point where it's not just a question of what ideas get forward, but what ideas are blocked at the door, mostly because of, you know, whether it's institutional interests and lobbyists or they just say, well, that's not going to go anywhere, and so we're not even going to talk about it. And I think that's real lack of courage and disempowered public. Finally, I want to sort of circle back to, you know, we're going to have to, in this country, build movements that get big ideas if we're going to turn this around. We really have to build an institutional left. We don't have to build institutions that get Democrats elected so much as we build institutions that are independent of the parties and drive ideas into public discourse. And I think that's been a failure of the foundation world and others who are really trying to grapple with the fact that the right has built this huge structure. It has failed the foundations, I blame in particular, for not responding accordingly. By movement building, you know, unifying the policy institutions with a grassroots base. But there are groups out there, if you want to hear, I can talk afterwards. But on the question of epistemological failure and linguistic failure, I want to circle back to Bill's point, which he referenced in terms of starting with corporate personhood. And I think that this is the failure in the law. We have, and everybody saw this exposed pretty much in the Citizens United case, which was the expansion of political speech to corporations in a way that they didn't have before. But I would say, and I would suggest that more important for the healthcare industry has been an issue that has yet to be debated, and that is the expansion of First Amendment rights under the banner of commercial speech rights. And this relates very much to the things that you all know that the pharmaceutical industry does, like the marketing of disease or the direct-to-consumer advertising of pharmaceuticals, you know, outlined in various books that have come out in the past few years. Melody Peterson's book is excellent and a number of others. But I don't think we've done enough to deconstruct the right-wing, the business civil liberties movement, as they call themselves, push for commercial speech rights as a way to deflect regulation. They've used this to, for instance, attack or threaten an attack against the labeling of genetically modified organism foods. Or there was a threat, but they really backed down when they saw the popularity of the Do Not Call registry, but they were threatening to say that was a infringement on commercial speech rights. We saw the First Amendment raised during the media reform battle, where Republican-appointed FCC commissioners talked about the speech rights of broadcasters in terms of their rights to access our airwaves, a public asset, by the way, that they should have every right to monopolize that and exclude other voices. In general, advertising, I think the expansion of advertising, if you look at it, it is now globally about a $600 billion a year industry, and we are one of the few unique legal systems that protects commercial speech, advertising as commercial speech. In Brazil, I think it was Sao Paulo, I forget which city, the mayor, who was a conservative equivalent to what we would call a Republican mayor, banned all outdoor advertising with the help of the city council as a public health and environmental measure. You know, we have very little experience with these kinds of looking at public interest proposals, and we need to get into that. And in order to do that, we're going to have to challenge these legal doctrines that protect and threaten anybody who raises their head to challenge that. Tiffany's, one final example, is recently one of the things that sort of went through by stealth in the Dodd-Frank bill was this requirement of conflict mineral reporting by companies. And Tiffany's has now, in the SEC rules that have been offered as a result, threatened that this is a compulsory speech infringement on its First Amendment rights. I doubt that they would carry that into court because they'd probably lose, but it's the kind of thing that comes out of the right-wing corporate echo chamber all the time when these kinds of regulations come up. Thanks.
Thank you very much. We now have about 15 minutes for discussion from the floor. Please come back.
Yeah. Let's move over here because otherwise people look at this monitor.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Would you like to respond?
The point you raised about evidence, I mean, two things come up. The whole notion of a crisis is just a time of change, I think, rather than saying it's necessarily a time of negativistic change, is important. The evidence issue, though, is critical because I think one of the things that is implicit also to what evidence actually gets through is the idea of corporate influence on some of that. And certainly we've seen that in the past, and I think one of the things that's going to be very, very necessary with regard to what you heard from respondent speakers, is the insurance that the type of evidence that is leveraged is appropriate to the outcomes that are desired, number one. And number two, that implicit or explicit influence over the nature of that evidence and what it means is in fact kept distinct from commercial enterprise and influences. There are some real moves, as you're probably well aware, within the academic infrastructure, develop guidelines and policies that are much more responsive to different types and levels of evidence as an evidentiary house rather than just utilizing, for example, the Public Task Force on Safety's overall characteristics, but recognizing that each one of those different levels might in fact be very, very viable to different patient ends in different communities. So I think one of the things that you made an important point, that the type of evidence that is utilized, the nature of that evidence and its value for particular ends and goals with different types of patients and how they could then leverage, for example, different levels of pharmaceutics, different levels of biotechnologies, approaches, etc. Very, very important. But it too needs that level of policing and it too needs that level of scrutiny.
because the problem we've had with much of that evidence is that it was, in fact, implicitly dictated and shaped, and that's an issue.
Any other comments, sir?
Well, I could just do a one-sentence one. I think it's possible that, perfectly possible, that the unexpected severity of the economic downturn and the home finance catastrophe might well be a fueling the beginnings of a social movement. But I agree with the colleagues here that it's a social movement that's much more important to recover than it is conceptions of evidence. The evidence at the margin, yes, but not. What we've been talking about, to the extent we've been talking about an environment taking shape over 30 or 40 years that rejects, really, the post-Second World War welfare state for America and wants to impose an altogether different social order, that is not going to be reversed by talking about evidence. It's going to be reversed by talking about what kind of society we want to live in, the extent to which we have a distorted conception of how our medical care system works, and frankly, as well, and the cost control side, I don't care what new ideas there are about evidence, cost control is always going to be controversial, and the presidents of the United States should say so. And the reason it's going to be costly is that you won't have cost control unless someone's income is less than it otherwise would have been. And no one's going to be happy about that. No one should expect it. And no country that I know of that has lower medical care costs has been able to avoid controversy over it. So it's an expectation which is not satisfiable.
Yes?
I too would like to address the ideas, but I'm intrigued by Professor Giordani's paper. And I'd like to take this in a direction from away from policy, but the implications for some of the vocabulary you use. I will first of all say I really didn't follow it all. It would have helped if I had examples. The examples of pain medication that involve pharmaceuticals that I remember most recently, and my memory is probably hazy, were COX-B inhibitors, and it didn't seem to apply very much to what you were saying. And you mentioned genographs, which if I understand what that seems to imply semantically, I didn't think we were very far along. But it seems to me it's really important, the emphasis you gave on our current epistemological capital. Because if I understood what you were saying, you were suggesting that, the human genome and the whole revolution we've undergone is an incredibly important advance or development, but we should focus on translational research coming out of that to, I guess, get more applied drugs following our current mandate. Maybe wrong, but my sense is the financial papers or pages are telling us that most of the pharmaceuticals have kind of run out of the big drugs. They're running off the patent, and there's not a lot in the pipeline. What intrigues me about I've only read one article about this, but to what extent is there perhaps a whole new, is there the foundation in the epistemological capital you talk about, of an epistemological breakthrough, of a whole new nosology, a whole new classification of diseases? Obviously, we started out in medicine with the notion that diseases were classified by their symptoms. Consumption, stuff like that, that got replaced by the notion that we look for the causes, the approximate etiologies of diseases, and that's where we basically are now, what caused the disease. But to what extent, rather than sort of focusing on translational, I think you call it scientia, should we really encourage people to rethink that some suggestion that we may have a reorganization of diseases because the human genome actually seems to have related parts of the genome that are related defects in a similar part of the genome actually stretch out to diseases we've never put together again. So if we really have a revolution, it's not based on our current epistemology, it's our current understanding of knowing based on what scientific method gives us, but rather that there may be beyond what we've been taking that further reach, or is that mere, I don't know, utopianism?
Maybe you can find me a single malt scotch after this, I'll tell you.
Okay, no,
really wonderful point. I was trying to write as fast as I could because your points were spot on. I mean, one of the problems also is that within a 20-minute presentation, sure, the ability to take a deep dive in any one of those is somewhat limited. You're right about some of the drugs that exist currently in the pipeline. However, one of the problems that we also confront is that, as you may be aware, most drugs are leveraged within an annual N of a viable patient population of 100 to 250,000, in other words, viable cases that are sustainable. If you're then taking a look at particular pathologies that have a much smaller N, the sustainability for big pharma is not necessarily there. However, small pharma or venture capital is. One of the problems to date, as you know, have been that the number of drugs that enter the pipeline versus the number of drugs that come out of the pipeline is very, very disproportionate for a number of reasons, some of them financial, others obviously having to do with safety and efficacy and efficiency ratios. However, one of the other things that we're finding is that the very science that allowed us to understand the human genome and its individualized genetics is also important, because what it helps us to do is to take this fairly large portal of drugs and essentially streamline that, so that we're not being able to say, I'm going to take a buckshot approach, but rather what we may be able to do is to develop particular pharmacological compounds that work for certain individuals and cohorts based upon genomic, genetic, particular phenotypic characteristics. Now, that's an epistemological shift, which then speaks to your last point. The other issue then also is you raised the point about high tech, and the one that you used as an exemplar was the genograft. Well, here once again what we're seeing is that, in fact, this is science that is progressing fairly quickly. However, it's progressing fairly quickly on the basic science level, and it does not necessarily have the strong impetus to have the translational effects for a number of different reasons, not the least of which is that the funding bodies that would enable that very high translational focus are simply not funding those studies for a number of reasons, and we can talk about some of that offline if you'd like, but not the least of which is that the nature of those studies are exceedingly expensive. So what you then find is a paradox. On one hand, you'd say you want these studies to be funded in a way that is at least as non-parochial as possible, so one would then turn to the national institutes or independent foundations for this. However, the funding base is not there. If you're taking a look at those funds for the past 2 years that have been in the single digits, 9% of NSF and NIH grants being funded. So then you have to turn to other funding resources inclusive of the commercial sector, and then we get into all of this problem. So there's a bit of a catch-22 and a paradox, and that needs to be sliced through like a hot knife through butter. I don't necessarily know the answer, but I know certainly that's the question. The other issue then comes along with the idea of nosological reform. Let's put the DSM-5 in abeyance for a moment. Let's not talk about that. That's another can of worms. However, I think at the base of that, the kernel of that, if you dig through enough manure, the pony that's in there is the idea of some form of nosological reform that at least reappropriates the Sydenhamian method, saying, well, these are signs and symptoms that we then characterize to the generality of a pathology, we then recontextualize to its expression individual, to a very new concept that has been refined through the Human Genome Project and actually through decades of the brain, known as spectrum disorder. So the idea of classifying disorders as spectra that may have predispositional variables that engage particular environmental interactions creates something of that epistemological shifting architectonics that you spoke about, which is very, very important, because if one follows that to its logical conclusion, what you're then seeing is that there has been and needs to be appropriated an iatrogenic shift in what genes and phenotypes of particular pathologic conditions may be sustained by the progress of medicine. Interestingly, that then feeds back and says, therefore, it is the obligatory responsibility of medicine as a profession and as a practice, inclusive of all its enterprise, the commercial sector, the governmental sector, etc., to be able to address and effectively treat, if not prevent, those disorders. So it draws a nice full circle and raises wonderful, wonderful points, and I thank you for your insight.
Get a scotch
for him. Yeah. No, he's buying it
to me. I said get a scotch for him.
Okay, I would like to ask the members of the panels if they have any questions from one another. We have another 5 minutes or so, at least.
You guys had a chance to ask us, comment us. We didn't have a chance to comment on you. And I have one.
The next session is starting.
Are you waiting for the next session?
Yeah.
Well, okay.
And then we'll carry it on.
The next session is not going to be starting till 4:30. So. Yes. Okay. Well, let us have 5 more minutes, and please go ahead, Todd, with your question.
Well, the central response I had to both you and Charlie was this: I agree that corporations seek to pursue their interests and do so in a variety of ways, some very unpleasant. Support the creation of a neoliberal conception of American government, but those corporations are elsewhere as well. You don't seem to need to have any purchase on a comparative understanding. If the idea of the corporation as a person were so powerful, why is Canadian National Health Insurance permissible? Why? And none of those. You're giving weight to it, and you're also, it seems to me, associating activities with causation. It doesn't follow that because money was spent in a campaign, that money caused it. The money may have followed the selection of the candidate. For goodness sakes. I mean, there's a lot of political analysis that does not have this linear conception, but much more importantly, the corporation as a person is a feature of corporate law. And in all places, we don't have the United States outcomes. That suggests something other than the corporation as a person is producing the result, does it not?
Well, that's a complicated argument. First, the corporate personhood question is embedded within the U.S. legal history. Not outside as much.
And as much, right. So degree questions, maybe.
It may be degrees. I don't think it's that. I don't think it's that pivotal anywhere else besides the United States here. And then even here, it certainly wasn't brought about for any legitimate means. If you look at that Santa Clara case, but that's another question.
Yeah, right. And I agree with that.
But I wouldn't. I don't think personhood is necessarily all that critical to a lot of what we've discussed here today.
Well, that's the point that I was raising.
Yeah, I would probably agree. But these things sort of that is so deeply embedded in the law that you wouldn't see it. Personhood doesn't come up in any litigated sense.
Well, anybody was is invited. Anybody is invited to continue the discussion just outside. So please join us outside.
Thank you.